Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jane Smiley, whose latest novel is Private Life. Earlier novels include Good Faith, 10 Days in the Hills, 1,000 Acres. There are 12 adult novels in all, 1 young adult novel, 4 nonfiction books, including a book titled 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel. Private Life, the latest novel, takes place over the first half of the 20th century. Actually, it starts in the 1880s, and is the story of a woman from the Midwest, from St. Louis, who gets married and moves to Vallejo, California. Her life occurs with the background of several influential events, including the San Francisco earthquake, the flu of 1918, World War I, World War II.
I should point out that she doesn't grow up in St. Louis. She would be much more cosmopolitan if she did. She grows up in a small town along the Missouri River. So she's really a small town girl, and that affects both what she sees as her future and what her mother sees as her future.
Well, she winds up marrying this man, Captain Early, who is somewhere between a real scientist and a crank. You said at one point that you didn't know how to bring in humor into the book. It's really funny because I was laughing at Captain Early through the entire book.
Well, that's true. He's an absurd figure. He's a megalomaniac, but he is very sincere. And the thing that he is desiring to put across is not primarily his own ego, but his own theories of the world and of the universe. And that, in a sense, is, he would say, let's put it that way, he would say that that's a kind of selfless act on his part, that it's not so much that he wants to be famous, though he does, it's that he wants his theories to prevail. This is not so far outside of the mainstream in science, in the history of science, I have to say.
Well, he's based on a real person.
Yes, he
is. Who's related to you, right?
Yes, my grandfather was the youngest of 10 children, and there were 4 sisters and then 6 brothers, all born over this course of about 30 years. And one of the oldest sisters married a man named Thomas Jefferson Jackson C., who is still a figure on the Internet. If you type in his name, he's still present, even though he's been dead since 1962.
Jane Smiley, in reading afterward about what you've said about the book, you talk about trying to figure out, get inside these people's heads and figure out what makes a man like Early tick, and why would Margaret Mayfield go for that long in clearly an unhappy marriage? And it struck me that even though she's the protagonist, I don't want to say the narrator because third person, but to some degree we see things from her eyes. To me, she remained fairly opaque.
I think to herself she remains fairly opaque. Okay. What is there to encourage her to be introspective? I believe that there's a point of introspection beyond which she can't go because she can't act. If you look at the divorce laws of California in that day, you couldn't divorce a man for beating you. You could only divorce him for beating you really a lot. There is a character in here who does get a divorce, and she can only divorce her husband once he's bought the mistress a house and produced a child with her.
At the end of the book, she stops being opaque.
Yes. She finally is overcome by the need to look within, and that's why the book is named Private Life. And it's not merely, you know, marriage laws and divorce and that sort of thing. It is that she has had what we would call a traumatic childhood. It's not only things that have happened to her, for example, the death of her 2 brothers and the suicide of her father. It's also things that she's witnessed in post-Civil War rural Missouri. Why go there, I think, is her attitude. There's no hope for it. There's no help for it. No one is going to say to you, honey, what do you really feel about blah, 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 blah? Really, they're going to say to you, look on the bright side. Things happen. You need to get on with it. And that's the way the world was in those days. You had to get on with it because life was cruel. And that's one of the things that I wanted to explore in the book, that there's a price to pay. She actually doesn't live a horrible life because she does get to move away. She does get to live a much more cosmopolitan and interesting life in a very beautiful and much more interesting area than the place where she grew up. She knows interesting people. So what is the price that she has to pay for that? Well, it's a pretty big price by the end of the book. But there is no alternative, really.
Very early on, she witnesses a hanging, and she spends most of her life denying that she either remembers or witnessed it until the very end when she says, yes, I did, and yes, I was there. How conscious was that? Was she just denying it because she didn't want to deal with it, or was she denying it because she was repressing everything in order to live her life?
I think the experience which took place when she was 4 was so terrifying. And the reason it's so terrifying, it comes out in the last page of the book. So I think the experience was so terrifying that she didn't think that she had the wherewithal really to grapple with that experience. I mean, these are feelings that we get when we're children, that a certain experience is so overwhelming that I better just put it out of my mind or forget about it, do my best to forget about it. And then quite often we are praised for forgetting about things or putting them out of our minds. And so the fact that we wouldn't think about it anymore is reinforced. What happens to Margaret because of this experience is that whenever things seem to be getting out of control, she has a kind of feeling that she's been rendered passive. She's just an audience member. A drama is taking place. It doesn't really involve her. And yet it's terrifying, and it's a kind of, we might call it a kind of fugue state or something that she goes into. But she has no access to, let's say, a psychotherapist. And her relatives say, well, such a good thing that you don't remember that. You know, certain of our family members sort of rush around into those sorts of things, and look what happened to them. You know, to be a good person, to be a good member of society, it's better to just sort of forget certain things. The culture was different in the beginning of the 20th century than it is now. And the theory of how to live was different. You know, the theory of how to live was that you simply endured and got on with it as best you could, rather than grappling with these issues.
Jane Smiley, she's told throughout the book, and she thinks of herself that way, as a very ordinary, not very bright, not very interesting person. Yet there are these hints that bubble to the surface. Her interest in her friend the spy later on, certainly her interest in Oriental art, would indicate that this is a very bright woman who is being stifled, and yet nobody, including herself, can see that.
She's not educated. She goes to school a little bit when she's a child. But really, the people that she looks to for judgments about who she is or what she's capable of, these are her relatives, and they've kind of made up their mind. In our day, and when I was a girl or a teenager, if your family wasn't all that impressed by you, well, there might be some teacher or there might be some person outside of your family who would see something in you that was worth cultivating. If you live in a fairly closed environment with a kind of very self-sufficient family, their judgment of you is essentially what you imbibe. Her brother-in-law's younger sister manages to escape this, but it's only because she has the money and the sort of ingenuity to get out of town and have a different life than the life she was meant to lead. And she becomes a progressive woman journalist in Europe and San Francisco. So she's the counterpart. She's Margaret's counterpart, the other plain girl who was too rebellious to believe what they said of her. It's not that they didn't try.
What this shows me is that, in a strange way, because it is third person, the book has an unreliable narrator. In other words, you need to see beyond the narration.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. The first time I wrote the book, the first draft of the book, was in the first person. And I found that Margaret was much too reticent. And so we didn't have any access to her emotional life or her inner life, really, because she didn't have any. And that was part of the point of being her and being someone like her. So when I changed the narrative voice from the first person to the third person indirect, then I could show her and her life and the world around her in a way that she maybe wasn't yet perceiving. And yet I could allow the reader to perceive some things, both about Margaret and about her world, that Margaret herself wasn't, you know, maybe she was perceiving them and not acknowledging them. That's why the book's called Private Life. You know, our private lives are something that in some ways are a mystery to us. We have to both perceive what's going on within us which takes some learning and time, and we also have to acknowledge it. And then once we acknowledge it, there's this momentum toward doing something about it. But if you live at a certain place or a certain period or in a certain situation, there may be nothing you can do about it, or the things you can do about it may be so radical that you can't even imagine them. And so, in some sense, she is in that position where, why bother to look within? Because what good is it going to do you? And that's what her mother would say. Her mother would say, what good is it going to do you to ask these questions, dear? Because there are no answers.
Which is why when at the end or toward the end of the book, when she realizes that not only is her husband a crank, but he's always been a crank and she's always known he's a crank.
Well, isn't that how revelation comes?
Right.
You know, revelation is a function of putting together hints. But the hints have been around for a long time. It's just that they've become coordinated and they've expressed themselves. To me, that's the interesting thing about life, that our minds work over certain problems, and then boom, something comes together and you say, I know that. And then life goes on, and that thing that you thought you knew sort of falls apart again, and you have to work over it again, and it coordinates itself into a different thing. So that's one of the reasons that I wanted this book to cover 50 years, because I wanted to talk about the evolution of a single person's perception and a single person's way of thinking in one, you know, 320-page book.
Jane Smiley, when you come up with an idea for a book, it's pretty obvious in looking at your work that there's some kind of trigger, something that drives you, like Horse Heaven is pretty obvious,
yeah.
You know. 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel mm-hmm. becomes pretty obvious, you know, once you've read the introduction to the book. What was it before Private Life that put you onto this tack of looking for the way we respond over 50 years and the changes in how we deal with external impressions internally?
Well, since the inspiration was characters that I knew about, and just these colorful characters, I didn't know how they were going to come together. I didn't know too much about what I was going to do with them. But I thought that in general, the idea of these two people moving from small town Missouri to California and having sort of that revelation, that world opening up that happens, and happens in our time and would have happened even more in their time. I think that was probably the first seed. But you never know how the seed is going to flower. You know, you don't even know how the seed is going to have shoots, much less flower. And so you have to, as a writer, sort of leave yourself open to seeing what aggregates around the first ideas and how they mesh with one another and then what comes of them. And that's what I like to do as a writer, is to have an idea, which is very kind of small, and have it grow and build and change. And so at the end of the book, I scratch my head and say, wow, that's not what I started out to do. But it has its own energy and its own internal logic, and so you just have to go where it goes. You can't be beating it into shape all the time.
The previous book was a wild book about Hollywood.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, 10 Days in the Hills. I still think of that book all the time.
Based on Decameron. So afterward, were these people, had they been swirling around in your head, these ancestors, for some time?
And, yes.
And so finally you said, this is the time.
Yes, I actually thought I was going to write Private Life before 10 Days in the Hills. And then 10 Days in the Hills just presented itself and said, you must write me now. And I did. I enjoyed it completely and thoroughly, and so then I went on to this.
Your book, 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, in the preface you talked about the different ways that you try to view a novel. Well, maybe all novels are mysteries. Well, maybe they're all historical novels.
Well, no. Actually, what I said is that when I am in the midst of a particular novel, the form of that novel is the lens through which I see all novels. But then when I'm finished with that novel, the lens goes out with the novel. And, you know, some other lens comes in with the next novel.
What do you think the lens was in Private Life?
Biography.
So at that point, it felt as if every book was a biography.
Yes, all books are character-driven or something like that. I mean, in 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, there's a chapter. It has a diagram of the novel. It's a clock with 12 stations on the clock. And they are all the 12 forms that have influenced the rise of the novel. And one of the things I discovered when I was writing 13 Ways is if I took those 100 novels and plotted them in accordance with the stations on the clock that they were making use of, they all made use of two primary ones. Some of them made use of 6 or 7 stations. Some of them made use of 2 or 3 stations. And the promise was, and the reader understood this as well as the writer did, so the promise was that if the novel, say, was making use of the essay station and the biography station, then you, the reader, would learn something tangible and intellectual and objective about the life of a certain person. You would come to understand that life probably better than that person did. And if you didn't get that, if you as the reader knew those were the stations or knew kind of instinctively those were the stations being made use of, and you didn't get those two things, then you would be disappointed. It's like there's a station in there that is the station of the joke. And that's what we expect from a comic novel. A comic novel can give you zillions of wonderful things, but if it doesn't make you laugh, it fails as a comic novel. So I know that, for example, Private Life makes use of different novel ideas than Good Faith does or than 10 Days in the Hills does. And that's my pleasure. My pleasure is in, you know, playing around in the materials that go to make up novels and enjoying putting things together in new ways.
When you finished Private Life, did you even try to parse it in that way or just kind of go, well, I feel this book is successful, therefore I'm done with it?
Having written 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, I was quite conscious of my own theories of the novel. I did attempt to write a novel that coordinated with my own theories, at least to some extent. And so the fact that it's gotten so many great reviews and people really seem to like it, it's a vindication not only of the novel, but also of the theories that I came up with in 13 Ways. However, that doesn't mean necessarily that the next novel I write will adhere to or vindicate those same theories. As I said before, a theory is a lens. If it's helpful, if it helps you see something and get through your task and come up with a good product, hallelujah, go for it. I set out my theories in 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel. Somebody came up to me at the LA Book Festival, the woman who won the Mystery Award, and she said this book taught her how to write her book, and she won the prize. I said, hallelujah, can I brag about you, you know? That's the great thing about the novel. The novel as a form is always, always, always imperfect. There may be novels that are great, like War and Peace, but they remain imperfect. So as they get bigger and bigger and bigger, they get more compelling and less perfect. That lets young people, that lets people who are interested in the novel, that lets them in the door. They can say, oh, I read War and Peace. That wasn't so good. I could do something better than that. Pretty soon they're halfway down the road toward writing their own novel, which is what they should be doing.
We all know that over time our own views change, mm-hmm. like Margaret's views change. So
sure.
Don't those stations of the novel change as culture changes?
If we were to open the book and look at the stations, we would see that they are permanent forms of literature, each of the 12 stations. Essay, biography, joke, tale, gossip, confession, diary, epic, romance. I can't remember what. Travel literature, that was station number one. So every novel that I found sits inside that clock, partaking more of one or the other. For example, early novels from the 17th, 16th, and 17th century, partook a lot of travel writing because the world was new then. That's not so much true in our world. But even though they partake less of travel writing than they did, they still can partake of travel writing. For example, science fiction is a great partaker of travel writing because you can either travel physically to another planet or another time, or you can travel internally into another being, like a werewolf or whatever, or an alien robot or something like that.
On some level, then, a really good atmospheric historical novel is also a travel novel.
I would think so, yeah.
To that degree, there's definitely travel novel elements in Private Life.
Absolutely,
yeah.
I actually love historical novels, and I like to read them, but they date the most quickly because every depiction of a particular historical time is a theory about that historical time. and theories change, so that 100 years after that historical novel is written, people will look back on it and they'll say, oh, well, so-and-so was Dickens, let's say, was wrong about life in France in A Tale of Two Cities. And so the novel, A Tale of Two Cities, becomes twice removed from us in a way that, say, David Copperfield is not twice removed from us, because Dickens is writing David Copperfield in sort of his current consciousness. You know, I know that this is the fatal flaw of the historical novel, but when I wrote The Greenlanders, I knew that The Greenlanders was going to be outmoded. It couldn't help being outmoded. But the drive to understand, the drive to figure out, the drive to see that ancient place and understand it is, I think, a very strong drive. And so we can't resist. Some of my really favorite novels are the trilogy called Kristin Lovren's Daughter by Sigrid Undset. They're novels written in the 1920s about 14th century Norway, I think. And I love them. But if you read them in relationship to what we know now about medieval life and medieval Scandinavia, they've become outdated. They've remained interesting because of the fabulous characters and the fabulous depiction of the world by Sigrid Undset. But they aren't true. They aren't true in the way that a historical archaeological record is true. The other side of this is, and I always think of this in relation to Emile Zola, all novels are constructions, and usually the most dynamic novelists have theories of the world and theories of how things work that motivate them to make these constructions. The first thing to go when a novelist dies is his theory. His theory becomes outmoded. It's no longer of any interest to anybody, except in an academic way. But as a driver of the novel, who cares what Zola thought? But if you go to The Belly of Paris or The Lady's Paradise, you see that his characters, his observations of life in Paris, his sense of story, these are the things that cause those novels to remain interesting and current. If you have the story and the characters and the kind of energy of composition that someone like Zola had, then people are going to want to read your novel, no matter what your theory was.
Do you think that these theories could apply to film, let's say, or is this specifically a literary theory?
Well, I think they could apply to film, and I haven't given this any thought, but I think this only because there are films that I look at now that were hugely popular in their day because they were very avant-garde or whatever, and they just look boring now. Whereas there were films that were considered sort of popular junk, fine enough in their day, that still retain their freshness because of the acting or because of the script or because it went straight from A to B to C or something. I'm not a film theorist, so I can't go any further than that. But there are films that I really thought were great. Who cares anymore?
Well, also, talking to younger people, they won't watch black and white films, but more importantly, they can no longer relate to what we call the Hollywood acting pre-1970.
You know, they can't relate to Betty Davis? Are you kidding me?
I'm serious.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a shame. Poor them.
Well, I just wonder how much of that would translate in terms of stylistically in a novel.
Well, we'll see, won't we?
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, we live in an era when many, many, many novels are in print. And so any given person, any given young person even, can follow his or her desires and pleasures. And quite often, the pleasures in reading a novel lead you from simple to complex. After you've read the Bobbsey Twins enough, you're going to go on to Nancy Drew. After you've read Nancy Drew enough, you're going to go on to Agatha Christie. After you've read Agatha Christie enough, you're going to go on to Charles Dickens. As long as the books are in print and somebody is going from one to another, you don't know how it's going to work out. The biggest market in fiction now is young girls, preteens, YA girls, teenage girls. If they're still a booming market, I cannot believe they're really going to stop reading in the next 20 years. I just can't believe that. I think it's a habit that continues and builds upon itself. What they're reading, I don't care what they're reading, as long as they're reading.
Is that one of the reasons you wrote your young adult novel?
Yes, it is. Well, one of the reasons. But I really love horses, and I love horses' personalities. Horses are quite unique, and they're actually quite expressive of their personality. Somebody said to me, an editor said to me, well, there's no horse series for girls anymore. And I said, you're kidding me, because that's what I grew up on. You know, the Black Stallion, all those books. I instantly said, well, I can write one. You know, if there isn't one, I'll write one. From my point of view, I live in Carmel Valley, California. And the Monterey Peninsula was the proving ground for the current training method called natural horsemanship in some circles. This is not like my friend Flicka, where the horse bucks and bucks and bucks until it's sweating and exhausted and it's okay now. It's a type of horsemanship that is based on, or was based on, observing how horses related to one another and then enlisting their cooperation in the way that they enlist one another's cooperation. I thought, okay, if I'm going to write this series of horse books for girls, I'm going to write about methods of training as they changed in the 1960s and as they went from being very mechanistic and in some ways cruel to being much more observant and in many ways much kinder to the animals, and have resulted in gaining much more cooperation from the animals, especially cow horses and dressage horses. So yes, of course I have a pedagogical idea, but I also love all the horse personalities, and I love my child Abby, my protagonist. I love her having to deal with the mysteries of horse personality and having to make something of that. And so that's what those books are about. The second one comes out in October.
Jane Smiley, in the introduction to 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, you make the statement that September 11 altered everything. Okay, here we are 9 years later. A lot of people after September 11 said that irony is dead, the world has changed, and gradually over time, I wonder what's really happened other than this odd blip.
I said that in 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel. In the introduction, I think talking about my state of mind around September 11th, because I think for many writers and novelists, whatever they were working on at the time of September 11th just seemed trivial and stupid after the attacks. So what I did was, as a mode of escape, I went and found The Tale of Genji, which was 1,000 years old, in an effort to get away from all thoughts of September 11th. Well, the theme of The Tale of Genji is the fleeting nature of life. That was what September 11th was all about, too. So I kept reading these old books and realizing how current they were. And so as a result, I read 130 of them, actually. I talk about 104 of them, I guess. I read all those books, and I wrote about 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel. What I found was continuity, not discontinuity. The horrors of September 11th are certainly horrible, but they are akin to the horrors of World War I or the horrors of the Crimean War or the horrors of the Icelandic sagas, you know. So is life worse? Well, we have fewer illusions, let's put it that way, about the American project around the world. You can have lost your illusions on all sides. You know, if you're a certain type of person, you can have lost your illusions that the American project is working, but still retain your feeling that it's good. If you're another type of person, you can have lost your illusions that it's working and lost your illusions that it's good. And if you're another type of person, you can have lost all of your illusions, but you have good company, you know. You go back and read The Debacle by Emile Zola. You know, if you want to talk about consumer society, go back and read The Lady's Paradise by Emile Zola. It's not like anything new is going on.
My illusions were shattered in December 2000, and it suddenly dawned on me that, you know, the system's rigged.
I was quite upset about it, and I railed against that. But I wasn't permanently disillusioned. But I was disillusioned enough so that when Bush started flying planes over Iraq in an attempt to lure Saddam Hussein into war, I wasn't surprised. I was disillusioned enough so that when there was all that Enron California stuff, I knew we were being shaken down.
These disillusions that you had, that I have, how do you think those disillusions play into private life, writing it now as opposed to writing it, say, before 2000?
I don't know. I would never thought of writing it before 2000. I have no idea. The novel I wrote in the late 90s was Horse Heaven. In Horse Heaven, the wealthy rich people are viewed as positive characters in some ways, a little benighted in some ways, but they are viewed positively. I doubt if I would write about those type of people in the same way now. I don't know. Maybe I would. I don't know. Every subject calls out to you in a different way. You cannot predict how or dictate to the subject. It will come to you in a different way, and it'll reveal itself, and it'll form itself in a different way. And my political self, which I've written about a lot on the Huffington Post, is actually different from my artistic self. I cannot make them do the same thing. I just can't.
Why do you think that is?
Because the novel itself as a form is intransigent to a certain degree. And if you refuse to empathize with your characters, then they will die.
There's a writer named Joe Gores who said years ago in an interview that the problem with the novel is that it can never be politically correct because characters do what they do.
The problem with the novel is that it has a certain political nature, which is a kind of centrist liberal nature. And you can push it a certain degree to the right or a certain degree to the left. But you have to believe that individuals are worth paying attention to. You have to believe that the individual and the group are always at odds in some way. And you have to believe that they might be able to be reconciled, but they probably won't be able to be reconciled. Okay, right there, that's a political point of view. It's a political point of view in favor of individualism. So if I am living in a culture where conformism is generally accepted, then if I'm writing a novel, I'm writing a political object that is outside of the norm. If I'm living in a culture where nonconformity is accepted, then the novel fits right in. But it is just because of the shape, just because of the fact that they're individuals, that they live only through being depicted individually, and because they are almost always distinct from and in contradiction, live in contradiction to the group. Already you're heading down a particular political chute. You're not going to be able to write the great communist, you know, solidarity, work for the people, working class novel. You're just not. You're just not. And very few did. And one of the books that I look at in 13 Ways was Quiet Flows the Don. You know, when we read that now, it's impossible to buy it, even in Russia, because he's not talking about the motivations of individuals. He's talking about the motivations of party members.
I keep thinking in terms of private life that the moment you make the decision that you are going to understand Captain Early, right, the moment you get into his head, then you have a certain sympathy. It's going to change the book. You have to look at it from his perspective in order to make him
real.
You
have to look at his own, yes, you have to look, you have to empathize, which is to look at things from another person's point of view. And this is something that took place in the 19th century, right around the time that Dombey and Son was being written. In the 18th century, if a novelist wanted to depict an appalling evil character, like, let's say, if the Marquis de Sade wanted to depict some of his appalling evil characters, well, they had to talk. Because he didn't have a technique for getting inside them. As soon as they were talking, then the novel became more like a play. And you wondered why he was telling Justine all of his justifications rather than just torturing her. But in the middle of the 1840s, Dickens and some other novelists realized that they could simply see the world from their character's point of view. And once they did that, this opened all kinds of methods for them to show the nature of evil. But what you had to do in order to do that was, in order to have empathy, you had to risk sympathy. And so it, although it expanded the world of the novel, it also made evildoers human. And that has become a philosophical question that we have had to deal with, that they didn't have to deal with before that period.
Jane Smiley, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a trilogy called The Last 100 Years. I call it a family saga, and I'm on volume one.
How many pages is this going to be when all three volumes are together?
I'm sort of a numbery person, and so it's going to be 1,000 pages, and each volume will be 333 and a third pages.
And you're writing for the Huffington Post, too?
No, I don't write for them anymore. No. I don't have time, and there's so many people writing for them anyway that every thought that I would have has already been thought 6 times by the time I open the website in the morning.
And does that mean that you're not writing any nonfiction right now, or is there anything?
I just completed, or I am finishing the last bits on a book about the invention of the computer, which will be out in the fall.
You've been listening to an interview with Jane Smiley, whose latest novel is Private Life. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.